Psalm 49. You may have heard the story. There was a businessman who was being sued for a large sum of money for something that he was accused of. And he told his lawyers, you know, if this case goes against me, I'm done. My business is done. My life is over. So I think I might send a box of cigars to the judge. And his lawyer said, do not send cigars to this judge. As a matter of fact, when you're in front of him, don't even smile at him because he's very sticky about ethical issues. So do not do that. And so the trial went on, and at the end of the trial, the judge ruled for this defendant, ruled for this businessman. And the businessman said to his lawyer, well, I really appreciate the tip you gave me on the cigars. And the lawyer said, you tell me you did not send him cigars. Said, well, yeah, I sent him cigars. I sent him some of the finest Cuban cigars, and I put the plaintiff's business card in the box. Now, think about that for a moment. There's some humor in that, but there's, the Russians have a saying that in every joke, there is a kernel of truth. And there's a kernel of truth in that is the world that we live in. That we live in a world of unethical people. And Psalm 49, the psalmist gives us some advice. He gives us a truth for righteous living in an unrighteous world. How to live righteously in an unethical world. In the superscription there, we see that this was a psalm that went to the worship leader, went to the music director for use in the temple. And remember, the psalms, they are a collection, they are the hymn book of the temple. And these psalms were used in the temple. And it's a song of or for the sons of Korah. And remember, we had a psalm last week that was a psalm of the sons of Korah. And in all of their psalms, we should expect something that has to do with the theme of God's sovereignty. And this is a psalm about a wise man. He's going to say, my mouth shall speak wisdom. It's a psalm that the psalmist gives us. He gives us a philosophy of how to live in an unethical society. And I think it's pretty obvious that we live in an ungodly, unethical society. People have become very bold in their sins. Whether it's the killing of innocent children in Chicago over the weekend, which we will read again Monday what happened in Chicago, or whether it's the continued exposure of corruption in Washington that bombards the news daily, whether it's in our own local community, sin is everywhere. And we live in an unethical society. And that's true not only in America. This is something that is worldwide. When we lived in Russia, we had a friend. His name was Nikolai Ivanovich. And Nikolai was a contractor. He built commercial buildings in Russia. Nikolai was not a believer when we arrived there. His family was. But during our time there, Nikolai, he came to Christ. Christ saved him. And he told me after he got into the church and he began growing, he said, our family is going to move to America. And I said, why are you going to move to America? And he said, because as a Christian, I cannot live in Russia and be a businessman. It is impossible to be a Christian and live in this country and be a businessman. With the taxes and the red tape and the bribery and everything else, I cannot ethically live here and be a believer. So how does that affect us? How does a Christian compete or live in an unethical society? If you think of a businessman, how do you do that? Sometimes it's like playing the game of chess where your men have to move like the real men move in chess, and the other player, he can move his guy anywhere. Your knight has to go two up and over, and his knight can go across the board. Or playing tennis, where you have to hit the ball within the lines, but the other guy, he can hit the ball past the baseline. That's a tough game to win. As a matter of fact, that's an impossible game to win. But we are involved in that kind of competition in life as believers. The businessman is involved in that, just like Nikolai was in that type of competition. You know, he has to represent his product honestly when other people, they may say false things about their product. But the Christian businessman has to be honest, but he also has to make the sale. So what do you do in that world? If you're a contractor, Jason's a contractor. Jason's in that game. As a Christian contractor, he can't use cheap material that will be unnoticed and put it in a place that'll be unnoticed and be competitive with somebody who would do that. So how do you live in that kind of world? If you're a student, if you're in school, if you've studied, you've been in that game as well, competing with those who are willing to cheat or plagiarize their papers, and you're competing academically with those people. What's the danger of that? Well, the danger is that the Christian may embrace the wrong philosophy. We may say, I'm going to fight fire with fire. If they're going to do this, I'm going to do this. You know, when in Rome, do as the Romans. And we could embrace that philosophy. But the psalmist, he addresses a similar situation, and he doesn't approve of any unethical or ungodly philosophies. Instead, he gives us a different philosophy, a philosophy by which we can live in an unethical society. And I think the fact that he's addressing this kind of situation is clear from verse 5. Why should I fear in times of trouble when the iniquity of those who cheat me surrounds me? In other words, I'm living a godly life, but there are those around me who would take advantage, who would try to trip me up. Literally, the idea is that would reach for my heel and trip me. They're trying to trip me up, and I'm trying to live a godly life. And in verse 16, he says, "Be not afraid when a man becomes rich, when the glory of his house increases." He's not talking about all rich people, but he's talking about in the context of the unethically rich person. And living in that context, we could be afraid, or his listeners, it seems they were afraid, and they wonder, how are we going to survive in this kind of a world? And the psalmist gives us a truth that enables us to survive in that kind of society. So we're going to look at Psalm 49. It separates really into two parts. Verses 1 through 4 gives us an introduction, and then verses 5 through 20, 5 through the end of the psalm, he gives us really the teaching of the psalm. So we may say, you know, why don't we just go to the teaching of the psalm and forget the introduction? Well, the introduction gives us some good information that will help us to understand actually what he's going to teach us. So we'll look at verses 1 through 4, the introduction, and then verses 5 through 20, the teaching. In verse 1 through 4, he starts by telling us that he wants to be heard. He's going to tell us something wise, words of wisdom, and he wants to be heard. Now, that sounds like Proverbs, doesn't it? Proverbs chapter 1. Verse 20 says, "Wisdom cries aloud in the street. In the market, she raises her voice. At the head of the noisy street, she cries out. At the entrance of the street gates, she speaks." Wisdom is personified, and wisdom wants to be heard, and he's giving us wisdom. And he says, "Hear this, all people, give ear, all inhabitants of the land." This is a wisdom that is not found on TV, it's not found on the cable online feeds. It's only found in the temple, in the psalm. Actually, Psalm 73 is a similar psalm. It talks about the rich man, and it actually tells us that. Psalm 73, let me just read a couple verses for you there. Psalm 73, it talks about verse 3, "For I was envious of the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked." He says, I was buying into that philosophy. I was becoming envious of them. And then he describes verses 4 through 15. He describes those wicked, arrogant, rich people. And in verse 16, he says, "But when I thought how to understand this, it seemed to me a wearisome task until I went into the sanctuary of God. Then I discerned their end." This wisdom is not a philosophy of the world. You can't get this wisdom from the world. It is a wisdom that comes from God. And he wants everyone to hear it. He says that two times. He says, "Hear this, all people, all inhabitants, give ear to this." He wants to be heard. This is a philosophy for everyone. It's equal for everyone in the world. And he contrasts the rich and the poor and the high and the low. And the low should be encouraged and the high should be warned. And the rich, this teaching should sober them. It should wake them up. And the poor, they should be comforted by this teaching. So what is this that he's going to tell them? Now that he's given a word to them, he's gotten their attention, he wants them to hear, he wants everyone to hear this, he's going to tell them something about himself in verses 3 and 4. This is a wise man. He says, my mouth shall speak wisdom. He's going to give them some wisdom. Now this is, we've talked about this word before, this is a big word in the Old Testament, wisdom. It originally meant to have a skill. If you, in Exodus chapter 28, verse 3, it talks about Aaron's robe and sewing Aaron's robe and making the robe beautiful. And in chapter 28, verse 3, it says, "You shall speak to all the skillful whom I have filled with a spirit of skill." That's the English Standard Version. If you look at the NIV or some other versions, it will say, "whom I have filled with a spirit of wisdom." In other words, this person had a skill. He knew how to make a beautiful robe. In literature, this word became the meaning for having skill in life, having skill to live a life. And if you just think of someone in your own life who you consider a wise person, you look at that person's life, there's something beautiful about that life. There's a grace about that life. You admire that life. And when that life is over, they leave an impact on you. And that is a person who lives a wise life. And the psalmist is saying that if you'll listen to me, not just hear, but if you will hear and you will obey what I'm going to say, you will live your life with grace. And you will live your life with meaning. And when your life is over, you will leave something that will last for people. So this is a wise man. He's speaking wisdom. And his wisdom is going to give us insight. He says, "The meditation of my heart shall be understanding." Not only is this message something that will bring us wisdom, but the meditation of his heart brings us understanding. In other words, it will give us insight. This is going to be a riddle. He talks in verse 4 about, "I will solve my riddle." He's going to give us something that will help us to live well, and he's now going to give us some insight from the meditations of his heart. Now, when we think of meditation of heart, we usually think, you know, we just thoughts, we're quiet, we're thinking about things, but this word actually means both thought and speech. As a matter of fact, some commentators would translate this the utterances of my heart, or the words of my heart, or the speech of my heart. So Psalm 49 is going to give us insight. It's going to give us an understanding about the prosperity of the unethical rich. He's going to help us understand something about them. And it's going to be a proverb, in the form of a proverb. I will incline my ear to a proverb or an illustration, he says in verse 4. So he's going to help us to live well. He's going to help us to understand these guys. And he's going to do that in the form of a proverb. What is a proverb? It's a simple illustration, and it teaches a fundamental truth about life. We have all kinds of proverbs from our own English language, and other languages have proverbs. You know, things like a stitch in time saves nine. It's a proverb that if you got a piece of clothes and it's starting to rip, one stitch is better than nine later. And in life, if something is broken, fix it immediately, or if you don't fix it immediately, it's going to get worse. That's a proverb, just a short saying that teaches us something about life. All of the proverbs that we have in Scripture are like that. They're just simple little illustrations that teach fundamental truths about life. And he says, I'm going to give you that proverb about the unethical rich. And then he says, I will solve my riddle to the music of a lyre, harp possibly, some sort of stringed instrument. He's going to give us a message. It's going to be in the form of a proverb, but the proverb is going to be a riddle. It's going to be something that you have to think about. He's going to give us a statement that we need to think about, which will teach us a truth to help us understand the unethical rich in order to be able to live well in life. Introduction. So he's gotten our attention. He's going to give us something. So we need to listen. What is he going to give us? You know, by the way, I believe he is an inspired man as well. I think he makes a couple of statements here. The meditations of my heart shall be understanding, the words of my heart. I believe God is giving him those words. And he says also, I will incline my ear to the proverb. I believe God is speaking through him to his listeners. This is the inspiration of God in the life of this man to give this truth to his listeners and by his listeners passed down to us. So he's given us all of that. And now he's coming to the teaching. The teaching happens in verses 5 through verse 20. There are two stanzas here. There are eight verses in each stanza. It's equally divided. You'll see that after the first eight verses, the last verse is going to be the parable that he's talking about. And then you read down to the bottom to verse 20, and you read the parable again. So what is it? So if we start in verse 5, we count down eight verses, we come to verse 12. He says, the man in his pomp will not remain. He is like the beast that perish. Man in his pomp will not remain. His pomp, his honor, his glory will not remain. He's like the beast that perish. And then in verse 20, man in his pomp, in his glory, in his whatever he's showing in life, yet without understanding, is like the beasts that perish. So the riddle is, this man is like the beasts that perish. So our question is, who is this man who is like the beasts that perish? And what does that have to do with us? What does that actually mean? There are some things that we don't see about the beauty of these psalms because we're reading it not in its original language, and I miss those because I I don't know how to read their original language. We're hoping someday Josh will be able to help us with that. He's going through the agony of that right now. So I rely on others. But there's something very interesting here that is taking place. The difference between verse 12 and verse 20 in the original Hebrew is the difference, if we transliterated the word, the difference of one consonant. One consonant. The word translated does not remain in verse 12 is Y-A-L-I-N, Yalin. The word translated does not understand in verse 20 is Y-A-B-I-N, Yabin. So if we are Hebrews, if we are Israelites, we're reading this and we're saying, Yalin, he's like the beast. And Yabin, he's like the beast. And there's a beauty about this piece of literature. It's not so critical for us, but the difference is critical because it helps us to understand what kind of man the psalmist is thinking about. That he is a man without understanding. He is an unethical man. He is a foolish man. And he does not have the skill of living life the way God intended life to be lived. He does not have wisdom. He is a man like the beast of the field that perish. And he wants to make two points about this riddle. Two things he's going to say about this guy. And we have to think about that analogy about the unethical man. What is it about the unethical man that is like the beast that perish? And his first point he makes in verses 5 through 12. He makes his point and then states the proverb. And his first point is that the rich man's pomp, his glory, his life is temporary. That just like the beast in the field, his life is temporary. The beast in the field, what does he do? He gratifies his life temporarily. And so does the unethical man. I mean, if you just think of, you've seen cattle grazing and the cow eating the grass. He just eats to his heart's content. He just eats all day long. And he's satisfying this appetite that he has in his body. They're just going through life eating and eating and eating, and they're stuffing themselves and they're satisfying this desire they have, and all their stomachs, they're bringing it back up and they're chewing the cud just like the cattle do. And that's what they're doing. They're gratifying their appetites. But who would envy a cow? None of us want to be a cow. None of us want to sit in the field in the hot sun of Florida and eat grass all day. Why? Because we know the end of that cow. The end of that cow is he's going to be a nice New York strip steak on my plate at some point. He's going to be on my grill at some point. He is headed for destruction. And so we don't envy him. There's even a sense in which we pity him. We have compassion on him because we know where he is headed. And that should be our attitude toward the unethical, toward the ungodly man who's simply trying to gratify his sensual appetites in his body. He's simply wallowing in his wealth. He's treating others so that he is pleased. But it all ends in destruction. And no one with understanding, none of us who have this understanding should envy this person. And the psalmist is saying, this person has a certain end, just like that cow. The cow is headed for the butcher shop. He's headed for destruction. And so is the ungodly, unethical rich man. His glory is temporary, and his doom, his destruction, is sure. It will happen. Now, you may say, you know, that seems pretty obvious. Isn't that the end of all of us? All of us are headed for death. We're all going to die. But that's one thing that we have a hard time comprehending or learning. You know, when someone is told they have a terminal illness, one of the first stages they go through is denial. We say, you know, not me. You know, there's got to be a cure. There's got to be a medicine. There's got to be a surgeon. There's got to be something new, because this isn't happening to me. There's a denial. And the psalmist, he is using several verses here to drive in this message that the end is destruction. He says in verses 5 through 9 that all of the wealth in the world cannot save us from that end. Look what he says. Why should I fear in the end, in times of trouble, when the iniquity of those who cheat me surround me, those who trust in their wealth and boast of the abundances of their riches? Truly, no man can ransom another or give to God the price of his life. For the ransom of their life is costly and can never suffice, that he should live on forever and never see the pit. All of the wealth in the universe will not save a man. That's why, in part, Jesus spoke of money the way he did. He spoke of mammon. He spoke of money becoming our God instead of God being our God. And that when we really need money, when we come to the end of our life and we've served money all of our life, money in the end cannot save a person. It has no value. It is unrighteous. And it's foolish to spend your life for that kind of God. It'll do you no good. And he says, not only will money not do us any good, but neither will education or sophistication. Now, is he saying any of these are bad? No. I would love to have many more Christian businessmen in our church. That would be a blessing. But what he is saying is, if these things take the place of God, they will not save a man. In verse 10, he says, for he sees that even the wise die. The fool and his stupid alike must perish and leave their wealth to others. It doesn't matter how wise you are, what your education is, your sophistication, how much you like the arts, or you know, how much you project yourself or think of yourself, or if you're a connoisseur of fine foods. None of that is going to matter on the day that you die. And that unethical, ungodly man is no better off than the beast of the field, because he is damned to the butcher shop, just like the cows. We should not envy him, but we should pity him. Luke chapter 12, verse 16. Jesus drives home that point. And he says, and then he told them a parable saying, the land of a rich man produced plentifully. And he thought to himself, what shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops. And he said, I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, fool, this night your soul is required of you. And the things you have prepared, those will they be. Whose will they be? So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. Is not rich toward God. What is the lesson? The lesson in this first stanza, as you think of the unethical people in life, in our society, in your sphere of influence, as you think of them being like the beasts of the field, they're not to be envied, but they're to be pitied. So the question comes to mind, what role do they play? Why do we have these unethical people? What value do these people have? Or what role do they play in God's world, in God's plan? What is their role? I mean, the value of the cattle, pretty simple. They're going to be good stakes someday. There's going to be a benefit. But what about the purpose of the unethical rich man? One man has said it this way, that the beast exists for our physical nourishment, and the unethical rich man exists for our spiritual nourishment. Now, what does that mean? What did he mean by that? Well, Judges chapter 3. In Judges chapter 3, we're told why God left all of the Canaanites in the land. Why didn't he just wipe them all out? Judges chapter 3, verse 1 says, "Now these are the nations that the Lord left to test Israel by them, that is, all in Israel who had not experienced all the wars in Cana. It was only in order that the generations of the people of Israel might know war, to teach war to those who had not known it before." Judges 3:1 tells us why God left the Canaanites in the land. He left the Canaanites in the land in his sovereignty to live among the people of Israel to teach God's people how to fight, how to compete with the ungodly nations, how to live among the ungodly nations, how to strengthen their muscles against the ungodly nations. You may have heard the illustration that our life is separated into three phases. Phase one is a phase of water and darkness. And we are totally dependent on our mom when we are in our mom's belly. And during that time, God puts eyes in our head and nose on our face and lips in front of our mouth, and ears, even though we can't see, we can't talk, we can't smell, we can't hear, he prepares us during that time for phase two of our life. And phase two comes 9 months later, doesn't it? Phase two is not water and darkness anymore. Phase two is light and air. And we could never have described in phase one what phase two was going to look like. But God was putting everything in us in phase one that we need for phase two, for this experience of light and air. Now, everything God has put in us, he put in us for survival, so that we can survive in this life. And this life lasts 70 to 80 years. Psalm 90 talks about that. It lasts 70 to 80 years. If you live longer than that, you start living on borrowed time, and time's getting shorter and shorter. My mom's 98. She's been living on borrowed time for a long time, and she'll probably outlive her kids, but different story. So we're in phase two, and in phase two, God does the same things he did in phase one. In phase one, what did he do? He put in things that we needed for the next phase. And in phase two, he's doing the same thing in our lives. He's putting in things in us that we need for phase three. What are those things? He regenerates us by his Holy Spirit. He gives us a new capacity. He gives us the capacity not to sin. He gives us the capacity to choose good and not bad. He gives us a new moral capacity. He does that by the Holy Spirit and through His Word. He puts in us love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, self-control. All of the fruit of the Spirit He puts into us by His Spirit and through His Word. And what does He use? He uses conflict. He uses struggle. He uses, in many cases, persecution. And that could be for us as well. He uses suffering. Because it's through suffering that we are brought into the kingdom of God. That is what we mean when we say that the unethical person is for our spiritual nourishment. He is preparing us. God is using him to prepare us, to build us spiritually, not to take a different philosophy and fight fire with fire, but he is growing us. He's preparing us for the time of eternity, the spiritual, eternal third phase of our life. He is preparing us for that. So the first point of the psalmist is, this man's doom is sure, and his glory is temporary. And so we don't need to compete with him. We need to pity him. We need to have compassion on him. Why? Because we have understanding. Now, he can't stop there. He's got to finish the psalm. Because he's got to show a difference between the unethical man and the righteous man. Because the destruction, everybody's going to die. We're all going to die. But he distinguishes between the unethical man and the regenerate or the ethical man, the man who knows God. And that leads us to the second half of the psalm. Because he's spoken of destruction, and now he's going to speak of the difference. What is the difference? For the unethical man, this is the difference. The unethical man, his doom is eternal, and his destruction is without hope. And if you contrast that to God's own people, if you know Christ, there is a new day. There is another day. There is an eternity. There is a victory. There is a hope. We sang about it. And we see how he develops this idea. Just as the beast finally dies, so do these ungodly, unethical people. They die without hope. It's an eternal destruction. Just look at a couple of verses. Verse 17, for when he dies, he will carry nothing with him. His glory will not go down with him. We always talk about, you know, you can't take it with you. Well, there's the verse. You can't take it with you. Verse 19, he says, his soul will go to the generation of his fathers who will never see light again. He started in darkness. He's going to end in darkness. Verse 14, like sheep, they are appointed for Sheol. Death shall be their shepherd. Death shall be their shepherd. He compares death to a shepherd. What's that like? I mean, what's it like to have death as a shepherd? Well, Psalm 23, which is a psalm I hope to do before we end this group of psalms. Psalm 23 says, the Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his namesake. What is it like to have death as a shepherd? Well, that shepherd would lead you to an unsatisfied state. He would lead you in pastures that are like a desert with no grass. He would lead you to streams that are dry. In other words, the man who has gone through life simply satisfying his appetites, He's damned to a state, an eternal state, where none of his appetites will ever again be satisfied. It will be hopeless, and it'll be painful. And you contrast that to the upright man in verse 14. The upright shall rule over them in the morning. Death will shepherd the unethical, but the upright, the ethical man by the grace of God, he will have dominion over them. There's an implication here of a new day, of a resurrection, of a new morning. And he makes that very clear in verse 15, but God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. I think this is one of the Old Testament passages that teaches about the resurrection of God's own people. It's not totally clear in the Old Testament, but we understand that we're not stuck in phase two of our existence. There will be a phase three. We have understanding given to us by the psalmist that the end of the godly is not an end without hope, but it is an end of hope, and it's an end of resurrection. Paul says that life and immortality have been brought to life by the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. That for those who have experienced God's grace and those who know salvation, they have the hope of another shepherd. Their shepherd is not death. Revelation chapter 7. Let me just read a couple verses for you here. It talks about those who come out of the great tribulation, and this is talking about a specific period in eschatological history, but I believe it has implications to all of us. Revelation chapter 7, verse 13 says this. When one of the elders addressed me, saying, "Who are these, clothed in white robes, and from where have they come?" I said to him, "Sir, you know." And he said to me, "These are the ones coming out of the great tribulation. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore, they are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will shelter them with his presence. They shall hunger no more, neither thirst any more. The sun shall not strike them, nor the scorching heat." In verse 17, "For the Lamb in the midst of the throne will be their shepherd, and he will guide them to springs of living water, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes." In other words, all of their desires will be granted. So this psalm, it's a riddle. It's a proverb. It's a simple proverb. It helps us to understand the unethical, ungodly world. It gives us wisdom in order to be able to live in that world the way God would want us to live. It helps us to understand that the unethical rich man, he's like the beast of the field. His glory is fading, it's temporary. But his destruction, it's eternal. And so what are the lessons for us in this? I think three things. Be encouraged, be moved, and be different. Be encouraged. Do not fear. Why? Because we know the end. We have understanding. We know the hope that awaits us. So when we encounter the unethical rich man of Psalm 49, be encouraged. because we know the end. Be moved. Instead of contempt in our hearts against the unethical rich, let compassion grow. Let a sense of desperation, of proclaiming the truth to those who would oppose us, to telling the truth about Jesus to every person who opposes us or attacks us or represents the unethical rich man of Psalm 49. And then thirdly, be different. Don't buy into the philosophy of the unethical rich person. Don't fight fire with fire. Don't be like the arrogant, unethical rich man. But remember the words of Jesus in Matthew chapter 6, verse 19 and 20. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. May this be a psalm that reminds us of our commitment to Christ, that we would say to Christ, because of your grace in my life, because you died on the cross and you shed your blood and you give me the hope of the phase three of my life, then I give you my life. Take my life. Take my silver and my gold. Take my hands, my ears, my mouth, everything that I have, all the phases of my life. Take them and let me not buy into the philosophy of the world to be like the unethical rich man. Let's pray together.